Thank you for that introduction. My understanding is that many of you received copies of the book that Clayton Christensen and I wrote called The Innovator's Prescription. I certainly hope the rest of you will get a chance to at least take a look at it during this conference. And if you like it, please do buy a copy. But basically what I'm going to present to you is sort of the core concepts that went into the writing of the book. Innosight Institute, which I have on the title screen, is the think tank for social innovation that Clayton Christensen and I and another one of his co-authors on a book on public education co-founded to continue furthering the research beyond the publication of these two books and to allow us to participate in conferences such as this. So first of all, I wanted to describe to you what is disruptive innovation. It's actually a set of theories that came out of the business world. We studied industries from all sectors and basically distilled the problem of how do you innovate in an industry and why is it that innovative companies one year all of a sudden disappear a few years later? And how can you predictably drive this innovation no matter what sector you're in? And our latest efforts in healthcare are really turning these lenses of disruptive innovation onto the healthcare sector. We've been studying innovation, not me personally, but our group has been doing it for the last 15 years. But when I joined, it was to help finally turn to one of the biggest problems that we all face in our society, which is healthcare, of course. So disruptive innovation basically starts out by saying that in any given market, there is a trajectory of performance improvement that a set of customers can utilize. If you think about how to envision this, well, customers are only able to have some use for technology in its nascent stage, and then they're able to grow with that, but oftentimes the technology will outstrip that ability. So another way to graph that is you have different tiers of customers, very demanding customers at the top who are never satisfied with the best products or services that a market can deliver to them. And at the low end, you have very simple customers who are satisfied by very little. Now, as I mentioned, there's a different trajectory of improvement that reflects the pace of technological progress that's introduced by innovative companies in any given sector. And as I said, that trajectory tends to outstrip the ability of customers to utilize that performance. So an example might be, if you think back to the earliest days of word processing, and do you remember how often when you were typing on that word processing software, how often you had to stop your fingers and wait for the cursor on the screen to catch up to your fingers? Because even back then, even the best microprocessors that could be delivered were not even fast enough to keep up with our fingers as they were typing. But as Intel introduced better and better products, pretty soon it far outstripped the needs or the ability to use that processor speed of most of the market. And as I said, there are always going to be some very demanding users at the top, hardcore gamers and such, CAD designers who need that performance. But for most users, the pace of technological progress has far outstripped the ability to use that technology. Now, some of these improvements can be incremental and small year-to-year improvements. Other times, they're big revolutionary leaps, but they all have one thing in common, and that's to sustain this blue trajectory of technological progress. All these innovations are meant to deliver better and better products to the most demanding customers in a marketplace. And we call these sustaining innovations simply because they sustain this trajectory of performance improvement. And when it comes to the party that's going to be most likely to develop these sustaining innovations, it's almost always going to be an incumbent firm, a company that is already well established in a marketplace that's going to be able to capitalize on its resources to deliver a better solution. On the other hand, every now and then, there's something we call a disruptive innovation. And a disruptive innovation is actually something that's not as good as what's currently available in the marketplace. And that's why we've drawn it in a lower demanding tier of the market where it first establishes a foothold. But by grabbing that foothold in an undemanding tier of the market, from there, it's able to improve year after year, just like the sustaining innovations before it, and continue to draw market share away from the incumbent leader. So that's basically the theory When it comes down to explaining, though, who will actually be the victors in these battles of innovation, what's interesting is that when a disruptive innovation enters the marketplace, almost always it's a new entrant company that is able to take over the marketplace. Now, in order to see why, I'm going to use an example from the steelmaking industry to make it clear why something that makes so much sense when it comes to innovating for new customers almost seems impossible for successful incumbents to do. Now, for those of you who didn't grow up making a lot of steel, I can tell you there's basically two ways of making steel. The first is in a large integrated mill. These are facilities the size of many hundreds or many thousands of acres. In today's dollars, they would cost probably $10 billion to build. Alternatively, you can make steel in something called a mini mill. Any mini mill uses electric furnaces to boil down scrap steel. And you could probably fit 4 mini mills in this room. Now, because these mini mills basically are just boiling down existing scrap metal, their costs to produce steel are much lower. In fact, it's 20% lower than the cost to make steel in an integrated mill. And they're able to downscale everything because you don't need all this. You don't need these giant manufacturing facilities and rolling processes to make steel at a mini mill, simply because you start out with such a small electric furnace. Now, what's interesting is that despite the advent of mini mill technology, not a single integrated steel manufacturer has ever successfully built and operated a mini mill. Now think about that. If you're a CEO of a integrated steel mill, and in a good year, your profit margins are probably 2% of sales, and here you have a easily available technology that can lower your cost of production by 20%, don't you think it would make sense to adopt this technology? And yet, not a single integrated mill has ever done so successfully. And so, again, why is it that something that makes so much sense seem virtually impossible for a successful company to implement? Well, let's start out the story of the steel industry in the 1960s, when the integrated steel mills were the dominant players of the industry. And they made all the types of steel that were available in the marketplace. And that includes, at the very low end, you have something called rebar, or concrete reinforcing bar. These are the steel rods you find buried inside concrete barriers that line the sides of freeways, for example. Very easy to make, and therefore the profit margins are pretty low in that industry. And at the very high end, you have sheet steel, things that are used in cars and appliances. Very difficult to make, and therefore much higher gross margins for makers of sheet steel. And as I mentioned, integrated steel mills really made the entire gamut. Now, when mini mill technology first became technologically viable, this was around the late 1960s. And because they were just melting down scrap steel, the quality of the steel that was being produced by these mini mills was pretty terrible. In fact, the only market that was willing to adopt and purchase the steel that was coming out of these mini mills was the rebar market. And that was because the specifications for rebar were not very stringent, and once you buried in concrete, you could never verify if it met spec anyway. So it was really the perfect market for crummy products. And that's where mini mills started. They grabbed that foothold in the rebar market. Now, in the rebar market, the integrated steel mills were, as I said, also producing rebar. But when they saw the mini mills starting to encroach on their territory, they were actually relieved to get out of that market because it was just a dog-eat-dog marketplace. The gross margins, in fact, were only 7%, and the entire rebar market only represented 4% of the overall tonnage of the production of steel. And so they were delighted to get out of that market, and instead, they decided to shut down their rebar lines and invest in angle iron and bars and rods, where gross margins were 12%, and they represented 8% of overall tonnage. And it made perfect sense, because why would you ever invest in a tier of the market that made you less money and represent a very small slice of your overall sales when you had the option of investing that same money in something that would make you more money in angle iron and bars and rods? And so it felt good for the integrated steel mills to get out of that marketplace, and it felt great for the mini mills to get into rebar because, of course, they had a 20% cost advantage. So both parties were happy, and there was sort of a peaceful detente until 1979, when all of a sudden the prices of rebar just absolutely collapsed. And the reason for that is because that was the year that all of the mini mills successfully drove out the last integrated player out of the rebar market. And it turns out that a low-cost strategy only works if there's a high-cost player in the marketplace. And once all the high-cost players left, all that was left was low-cost mini mill duking it out with low-cost mini mill. And that competition basically drove prices down to the point where nobody could make any money. And so what are these poor mini mills going to do? Well, for a while, they tried to make their processes more efficient, but that was really only a struggle for survival. The only way that they figured out was that they had to move up market, and they had to target the angle iron market and the margins of 12%, and they had to figure out how to make their processes high enough quality to target that market. But they were so desperate to get out of this dog-eat-dog rebar market that they were able to figure out a way to produce angle iron. And when that happened, the integrated steel mills' reaction was, boy, were they relieved to get out of that market, because it was just a dog-eat-dog market, and why would they ever want to invest in a market that only made 12% gross margins when they had the option to pursue structural steel? And so once again, they shut down the lines that were making angle iron, and they opened up or reconfigured lines to make structural steel. And all the while, Wall Street was rewarding them, because they were lopping off the lowest margin parts of the business and investing where margins were higher and where their highest demanding, their most demanding customers were paying the most for their products and services. So it certainly made sense to Wall Street. So at 18% gross margins and 22% of overall tonnage, the structural steel market was really the best bet for the integrated makers at that point. Now, in the 1980s, all of the technical experts in the steelmaking industry could see these barbarians at the gate. They knew mini mills were getting increasingly sophisticated at making more and more complex steel products. But they all said, they all agreed, that there was really no way for a mini mill to produce the structural steel that was used to support giant structures like the hotels you see propping up on the strip all the time, simply because the crystalline properties of steel in order to make structural steel could only be imparted by the seven-step rolling process that you found in a giant integrated mill. And you just didn't have those steps in a mini mill. And so it could never be done, they said. But the problem is, they didn't realize how desperate these mini mills would become, because in 1984, the prices of angle iron and steels and bars and rods collapsed. And it was, once again, because the last integrated player was driven out of that marketplace. And all of a sudden, it was once again a dog-eat-dog commodity with mini mill fighting it out against other mini mills. And so the only way that they could survive was to figure out a way to move up market. And they didn't start out by making giant structural steel beams for hotels, but they started out making little 4-inch I-beams that would be used to support mobile homes. And as they were butting up against the low end of the structural steel market, the response of the integrated steel mills was they were relieved to get out of this market. Have I told this story before? So as you can see, as they continue to move up market, really you're left with only the very upper echelon of the marketplace to serve. And that's very rarefied air. And as a result, every steel company has gone bankrupt except for one. And meanwhile, as the mini mills have crept up in the steelmaking industry, they now control 60% of the North American steel production. Now, as I told this story, you can see that I never used the word stupid management, because really every decision was logical. In fact, every decision was based on the general principles of good management that we teach in business schools around the world. Principles like always listen to your best customers, always invest where gross margins are highest. These are tenets that serve companies and business leaders very well when you're trying to go up the sustaining trajectory of performance improvement. But when an industry encounters a disruptive innovation, it actually shackles them from doing something to counteract the encroachment of disruptive innovation. Put another way, if you're David fighting off Goliath, if you were to encounter Goliath head on, In other words, in business terms, try to produce a product that was good enough to compete with the Goliath's best products for its best customers, Goliath is going to be motivated to use every resource at its disposal to crush you. On the other hand, your chances of success are going to be much, much higher if you choose to compete in a situation where Goliath is motivated to flee rather than fight. And really, that distills the point of disruptive innovation. So next, I'm going to take you through just a brief example of applying it to health information systems. So again, you can see traditional health information providers have moved up this sustaining curve, sustaining trajectory that I've pointed out here in blue. And I won't name names, but they are exhibiting, I noticed, next door. But you have big companies that may have started out as an LIS or a PACS system, but gradually added in administrative functions, billing, clinical information systems, and became a giant proprietary integrated solution to cover all tiers of the marketplace. Now, as a result, it's very expensive to implement, and they only target, really, the few hundred elite large medical systems in the world. And you contrast that with the recent announcement from a company I put here in green, which said, you know what, we're actually going to target individual doctor's offices and try to come up with a solution that can overcome some of the pricing barriers that some of these integrated players have not been able to serve. And we call this serving non-consumption. In other words, these are non-consumers because they've been overserved by the market, where products are either too expensive or too complex to really meet their needs, and therefore they are shut out of the marketplace. And in general, these high-end players have no interest in serving the low-margin customers. And the question is, well, is the next wave going to be personal electronic health records? You have initiatives from Google and Microsoft, but also a lot of other smaller players. And the question is, again, what's going to be their role? Because they're not going to be able to pair up with folks like Cerner or McKesson. They're not going to have any interest simply because of the disruptive innovation graph that I pointed out to you before. Now, another way to visualize disruptive innovation is through a series of concentric circles where, inevitably, industries start out as very dispersed and decentralized. We do things by hand, it takes a lot of labor, and it's very time and potentially cost intensive. And so one example is in computing, where probably it was before my time, but I know my dad and I know Professor Christensen carried around slide rules when they needed to compute. And anytime they needed to compute something, they'd take out their slide rule. And in the 50s and 60s, that began to centralize. And so we developed technologies that were very complex, very expensive, but could compute much faster and more efficiently than could we when using slide rules. The trade-off, though, was this centralization, where all of a sudden you had to go to some facility, a corporate mainframe center or a university computing lab, in order to compute. And you had to take your punch cards, hand it over to an expert technician who would do the computing for you. And so that's the general tendency of an industry when it moves from decentralization to centralization: more cost efficient, but potentially less convenient, because now you have to travel to the solution. But then over time, the industry will once again decentralize through disruption. And so what happened to mainframes is you got mini computers, and mini computers were smaller, more affordable, and therefore more people, well, not necessarily people, but more companies could own them. And then you had the advent of the personal computer. And in the 80s, of course, we saw an explosion of PC growth, where more and more people could afford to compute in their own homes or offices. And then laptops now are completely portable solutions, where people now can now compute on the road. And of course, now more and more people are computing using their smartphones. And so you see this gradual process of disruption make things more decentralized in an industry, and at the same time, give more people access to the technology of an industry. And we've seen this happen over and over again. Steelmaking was one example, where before you had only a few select areas that were able to support a giant integrated steel mill. And now with mini mills, they're small enough where you can operate them within a city block. Gambling was actually an interesting one. We've seen giant buildouts of towns basically devoted to gambling, and yet here with the internet, the question is that going to be the next wave of decentralization? And we've seen certainly the growth of online gambling, and the question is, what is that going to do to the centralized parts of the casino industry? I just thought I'd point that out given where we're located today. Now, the question is, what does this mean for healthcare? Well, I'm sure you were probably thinking of some examples as I was talking about decentralization in other industries. But basically, what's happened is that at the turn of the century, most care was done by physicians visiting the home or physicians doing their own laboratory testing and diagnosis in their offices. And over time, we've centralized that work. So now we have centralized laboratories that have become more and more centralized. So now you have only a very few select laboratories that are able to run things for most offices. At the same time, you have surgeons and doctors starting to coalesce into centralized facilities called hospitals. You have all the imaging equipment being centralized. And basically, the hospital, in the matter of a century, became the mecca of all that is done in healthcare. And the question is, when is it going to decentralize? Or is it, in fact, already happening? Well, certainly we've already seen some decentralization occur. We, of course, have more and more care being delivered in outpatient centers and clinics and doctor's offices. And the question is, can we continue to drive that out into the community? We've certainly seen some of that in the movement of retail clinics, where we've moved it out into community pharmacies and grocery stores. Can we, in fact, push it out even further into offices and patients' homes? And I think what's going to help drive that are basically some of the things that I think you guys are very involved in, which is point-of-care diagnostics. And the question is, what are the technologies that are going to drive decentralization and disruption in healthcare? A very big part of that is going to be diagnostics that enable us to provide care in different venues that are more convenient and decentralized and therefore lower cost, and at the same time use these technologies to equip different providers of care who tend to be lower cost. So again, retail clinics is a great example, because there we tend to use diagnostic tests in the hands of nurse practitioners rather than physicians. And so with lower cost venues of care and lower cost providers of care, you can see how healthcare can start to decentralize and we can start to disrupt this centralized facility called the hospital. Now, there are actually three enablers of disruption, and we go into this in detail in the book because it was important to discuss how each of these applies to healthcare. And I won't belabor the point, but again, if you're interested, I encourage you to pick up the book. But basically, disruption starts with what we call a technological enabler. And that's basically a technology that simplifies something that was once very complex or expensive to do and could only be done by very few people in the world. It makes it simple enough so that more and more people could do it. And so, you know, if you think back, mini mills, mini computers, and later personal computers, these were, in fact, enabling technologies. The microprocessor contained within the PC, for example, was the enabler that allowed somebody like Michael Dell to start building PCs out of his dorm room. So the first step is that simplifying technology. And again, with diagnostics, that plays a huge role in providing technological enablers for an industry, because with the right diagnostic, you take out a lot of the inherently complex and expensive guesswork on the part of diagnosticians. The second step is to put that technology into a business model that can make money. And that's an important step, because oftentimes we make the mistake in healthcare of coming up with a great technology and plugging it right back into the existing business model of the hospital. And I'm going to talk about in a minute why that's such a problem in healthcare. Finally, after the business model, you need to envelop that business model with a value network or partners that are able to support it as it goes to the marketplace. So you need like-minded suppliers and distribution channels, for example, in order to succeed. Otherwise, very rarely can you come up with a disruptive business and plug it into the existing value network and expect to survive. Almost always, in healthcare, for example, the reimbursement system will kill off most innovations if it doesn't want to pay for it. And so finding the right payment channels is a very important step, for example, in building the right value network in order to disrupt healthcare. And again, that's something that I'll address towards the end. But let's first concentrate on the technological enablers of healthcare. So in the early stages of literally every industry, the technical problems of those industries can only be solved through essentially what's trial and error experimentation. If you think back, an easy way to visualize this is if you think back about 60 years ago, when you needed a new organic fiber, there were only maybe a few dozen organic chemists who were able to provide you with the molecules to build these organic fibers, and DuPont employed almost all of them. And the way these scientists would practice their art is that they would mix a few atoms in a beaker, stir it, heat it up, draw out a fiber, look at it in a microscope, and take that fiber over to, or take that molecule over to their colleague's door and ask, what do you think I've got here? And she would probably say, well, I'm not sure, but let's heat it up for another 10 minutes and see what happens. And it's really just this trial and error experimentation with a lot of failures for many years that ultimately led to some blockbuster hits. Things like nylon, polyester, Kevlar. These are miracle molecules of the modern era, but really they took a lot of experimentation and a lot of failures to get those few blockbuster successes. Now, as DuPont scientists practiced their craft over and over again, patterns began to emerge. And all of a sudden, you could start to teach some of these basic principles of fiber design to other chemists. And you still had to be reasonably smart to play this game. But now, a lot more companies could enter because you could start to tell scientists, well, always start here but not there. If this happens, then do this but not that. And so you start to get these patterns that you recognize in this art. And from there, quantum theory became better understood. And what quantum theory allowed you to basically introduce was a rules-based process in the design of fibers. And you could all of a sudden predict in advance that if you had a molecule of a given structure, then these would be the properties of the fiber that you built out of it. And that allows you to write software that where you could reverse engineer a fiber whose properties you selected, and it would give you the molecule structure that you needed to build. And so these days, to build a new organic fiber or the next great hit, all you really need is a BS in Chemie from a state university and a great piece of software. And you can design better molecules faster and at lower cost than could the world's best scientists at DuPont just a generation ago. And if you stand up and turn around 360 degrees, you could lay your eyes or your fingers on a couple dozen fibers that have been just an unmitigated blessing to mankind. And yet those blessings did not come about by trying to replicate the costly experimentation and trial and error process of DuPont scientists by training more scientists. But instead, it came from disrupting their expertise through the development of scientific progress and software to replace the intuition that was basically embedded in these few scientists' brains. And so now, a lot more people can do this work at lower cost and in different venues instead of being localized only to DuPont. And really what we need to see is the same thing in healthcare, where we need to see disruption of physician and clinical expertise by taking what's embedded in physician brains and somehow trying to figure out protocols, software programs, and diagnostic tools that eliminate a lot of the trial and error experimentation that's so inherent to clinical practice over the last century. And what we call the typical practice in healthcare is intuitive medicine, because really it's dependent on the intuition of a few clinical experts. It's through their many years of experience and training. It's by a lot of practice and trial and error on similar cases and circumstances before doctors are capable of coming up with good solutions time and time again. And that's why it's so inherently costly to train a good physician, and it's virtually impossible to guarantee any reliable outcomes or measurements in the healthcare system, because you're relying so much on different people and different levels of intuition. But once again, as we practice our craft over and over again, we've noticed certain patterns start to emerge, and we call this empirical medicine. And another term might be evidence-based medicine. And basically at this stage, based on large clinical trials and studies, we're able to state, at least in probabilistic terms, well, this is probably what's likely to happen to you if we do this. And again, these are patterns similar to what was recognized at DuPont decades ago. And it's just now, over the last one or two decades, happened to healthcare. And so what's the next stage? Well, we call it precision medicine. It's probably interchangeable with the term personalized medicine, which most of you are familiarized with. But precision medicine, really, we use to refer to just the pharmacogenomic qualities of disease. We try to eliminate some of these behavioral and psychosocial aspects of disease, as important as they are, but that opens up a whole other bag of worms. And so, at least for purposes of our book and for our discussion, we chose to focus just on the physiological ability to target to the root cause of disease. So we decided to call that precision medicine. And basically, this disruptive graph was meant to show that as we start to move from intuitive to empirical to precision medicine, the ability to generate disruptive models of care delivery become more and more possible. And what's driving this? I mentioned before the diagnostic tests that we're developing, the imaging studies that are able to more and more precisely diagnose disease, and clinical information systems that are helping us basically narrow down populations to targeted silos of patients. And so, again, in the red arrow, these are the enabling technologies that we see driving precision in healthcare. So the question is, once you have those technological enablers, you know they're coming down the pipeline. The next step is, as I mentioned before, is to get them into the right business models. And as I said, this is really where healthcare tends to fail, because we have myriad technologies coming out all the time. And the question is, how do we utilize them to disrupt the healthcare system? So before I get into that, let me first just cover very basically, in general terms, what a business model is. And every business model will start out with something called a value proposition. And basically, that's the product or service that a company comes up with to help a customer do something more effectively that he or she was trying to get done before. In order to deliver that value proposition, a business will collect a set of resources. And this can include people, technology, cash, basically to deliver on that proposition. And then finally, after working together over and over to deliver that solution, a set of processes will develop. And so a company will develop ingrained ways of doing things to deliver on the value proposition. And then finally, you need a profit formula to support all of these steps. So how many asset turns do you need? What sort of inventory you need to collect? What sort of gross margins do you need to set to support the cost of the processes and resources that you've put together? And once a successful business has this formula in place, these four boxes start to interact with one another. And that's why it's almost impossible for a successful business to introduce something that runs counter to its successful business model. It is why an integrated steel mill finds it virtually impossible to implement successfully and profitably a mini mill. And it's why many computer companies like Digital Equipment found it virtually impossible to deal with the PC revolution, simply because their business model was built to sell mini computers at higher gross margins than the PC manufacturers could. So let's look at the traditional business model found in healthcare. And again, we'll look at the hospital. So what is the value proposition of a hospital? What is it claim that it can do for its customers? Well, really, a hospital says, whatever you have, bring it here, we'll figure out a solution, and we'll fix it. And if you look through the annals of business history, there is no business that can ever be successful trying to satisfy all customers by doing all things. It's just not possible to create an efficient business model doing such a thing. Because the resources and the processes that you have to put into place are so extraordinarily complex, with so many handoffs, so much overhead built in, that there will always be a more efficient business model to come in to take a share of that business away. And the markup that you have to build into your profit formula goes on a factor of 10, potentially, in order to cover the overhead costs necessary to support the processes and resources to deliver any solution for anybody. And so One of the case studies we introduced in the book was on something called Michigan Manufacturing Company. And basically, this was just a manufacturing plant in Pontiac, Michigan. And I'm not going to get into the details of the case study, but it's a very interesting one for all any of you who have ever been in the clinical setting. But basically, the manufacturing plant that we studied was laid out by departments. And I think anybody who's been in a hospital recognizes this also looks just like a hospital, organized into departments. And the protagonist of the case study at Michigan Manufacturing Plant basically was trying to figure out why the accountants from corporate were telling her that her plant was going to be shut down because her overheads were just tremendously high. And when she walked out to her factory floor, she realized, well, she was making all sorts of products, everything for everybody. She might have product A that would start in one area before it got shipped out, and it took a winding process through all the various departments to get it done. And there might be a different part that started in a very different area, wound its way through a very different maze before it found its way through the door. And she had 20 of these maze-like flows to her product pathways. And it turns out that that was really what was driving the overhead in her system, and that was really why the accountants were telling her she was going to be shut down, because there were competing plants in the same company that had taken not all 20, but just the one or two with the highest volume and laid them out in a straight line and said, this is all we're going to build. We're going to do it really well, and we're going to do it at low cost. And she couldn't compete with those people when she had so much overhead built into making everything for everybody. Now, at the same time, when we started to apply this concept to hospitals, we counted up all the different maze-like patterns that run through your typical hospital, and we estimate that there's about 100 different maze-like patterns winding their way through the hospital. And when you think about how much cost overhead that entails, how much potential error there is when it comes to all the various handoffs from department to department, how much complexity there is in any attempt to manage the accounting, to measure the outcomes, and to manage these processes, you begin to understand why it's so difficult to fix healthcare when you assume that the hospital is the right business model. So really, what we recognize from that study is that hospitals are really conflations of three different types of business models. In the whole world, there are basically just these three types of businesses. There's something called a solution shop, and basically the job of a solution shop is to bring together resources, experts, equipment, to come up with solutions to very complex problems through diagnosis. And examples of these outside of healthcare would include consulting firms like McKinsey, you have very high-end law firms, R&D organizations, high-end marketing organizations, and basically the idea is put some smart people in a room, give them resources they need, and they'll figure out the right diagnosis and come up with a recommendation for a solution. And really, in hospitals, traditionally, this is sort of the expected area for hospitals to play in, to be that diagnostic provider that comes up with the answer, because there you can find all of the necessary specialties and equipment that you would need to come up with a diagnosis. Almost always, solution shops get paid on a fee-for-service basis, because you just, as I said, you can't regulate an outcome because every process is different and involves potentially a large amount of trial and error and intuitive-based work. And so every once in a while, you might have a consulting firm like Bain say, well, just pay us based on the outcomes. We'll take a percentage of profits or some other way. But it never works because there's just no way to predict reliably the outcomes that you're going to get from a process like a solution shop. Now, you contrast that with another type of business model in the world called a value-adding process. And a value-adding process business are things like manufacturing, food services. They're basically businesses where you take in raw materials, you do something to it, and then you spit it out in a more complete or higher value form. And so food services, where you bring in raw ingredients, you do stuff to it, and you ship prepared meals out. That's an example of a VAP business. And this is really what we're seeing as the initial stage of disruption in the healthcare industry, because you're seeing some of the easy, more rules-based types of work being carved out of the hospital and traditional models of healthcare delivery and being put into things like retail clinics and specialty hospitals. And it's for these types of businesses that we're really able to pay on a fee-for-outcome basis. Because now, rather than relying on people and their intuition to deliver results, you're dependent on process, which is much easier to control and regulate. And you can even guarantee outcomes. So things like Geisinger's Proven Care Program, where they guarantee the results of their bypass surgery, or they'll redo it for free. These are things that you can potentially do once you reach this aspect of a VAP solution. Finally, there's a type of business model called a facilitated network. And these are where users are basically trading items of value with one another. So eBay is probably a recognizable form to all of us, but there are more traditional businesses that also fall into this category of business model. So telecommunications, where we all send data to one another, whether through voice or computer data. Insurance, where we all put money into a pool and we take claims out of it when we need to. Banking is another example. And we're starting to see some more of these facilitated networks arise in healthcare. The internet has certainly made things easier to find groups of patients or groups of providers who are able to share information of value with one another. Certainly the first areas I think we'll see adoption are for rare and orphan diseases where the knowledge just isn't that great. Where before you had to travel to a centralized facility to find a clinical expert knowledgeable enough to deal with your disease, now the internet allows you to connect in a facilitated network with other users just like you who can share their knowledge with you how to manage your disease. And so patients like me is one of several examples where like-minded people who share disease or circumstances are able to get together and share information with one another. And these businesses tend to charge on a fee-for-membership or a fee-for-use basis. And so, again, the problem with things like pay-for-performance, pay-for-outcome, these are very difficult until you're able to recognize what business model it is that you have in place. It's why when an insurance company says, I'm going to introduce a pay-for-performance program, a lot of doctors will object because they are trying to pay for some things that are simply not controllable. And it's because they're trying to pay different business models all using a single method. And again, that is also the problem inherent in our traditional fee-for-service model, which is outdated when it comes to paying for things that we could pay on a fee-for-outcome basis. So aligning the payment model and accounting methods with the appropriate business models to deliver care has to go hand in hand in order to disrupt the healthcare system. And so we'd like to see the hospital, at least in the first stage, there are a couple of stages that we outline in the book, but at least for the first stage, we'd like to see it divided up into what we call coherent solution shops, where you bring together clinical experts and the equipment they need to deliver diagnoses in a series of hypothesis generation and testing through potential solutions through that trial and error intuitive process. And then meanwhile, we need to carve out the value-adding process clinics that are able to deliver those aspects of work much more efficiently and effectively. In order for coherent solution shops to develop, just to make it more relevant to this audience, I think what we're going to see is a merger of the various information systems we have out there for diagnosticians. Because really, they're all serving the same primary purpose, which is to support the diagnostic solution shop work of hospitals. Now, the mistake we make in healthcare is that we cram disruptive technologies into existing business models like the hospital. Now, just as an illustration of why that is a terrible mistake and why it leads to tremendous cost and no improvement, is let's look at the example of the disruption of vacuum tube electronics by transistor-based electronics. So back in the 50s, most televisions, radio sets were based on a technology called vacuum tubes. And when the first transistor came out, companies like RCA, Zenith, and Westinghouse, the leaders of the industry at that time, tried to put transistors into their existing large television sets and tried to deliver a product that would be acceptable to their existing customers. And they just couldn't get it to work. They spent billions in today's dollars to try to figure out a way to make a transistor-based television set. Meanwhile, The first transistor-based electronic product was the hearing aid. And here was a perfect area of non-consumption because you could not make a hearing aid out of a vacuum tube, and therefore there was no marketplace for these people who were hard of hearing. And so they were delighted to have a transistor-based product, however crummy it was, because their best alternative was to have no hearing aid at all. And that's where transistor-based technology grabbed its foothold. A few years later, Sony introduced the transistor-based radio. And again, tinny sound, horrible reception, but Sony was smart enough to know that they were not building a radio to sell to existing customers of tabletop radios made out of vacuum tubes, but they targeted their radios to the rebar of humanity, people we call teenagers. And teenagers were delighted to have this crummy radio because their best alternative was to have no radio at all. And from there, Sony introduced a transistor-based television set. And again, first product was a tiny screen, black and white, horrible reception, bad quality in today's terms or in terms of people who owned the big appliance-sized televisions. But again, it was great for people who didn't have big enough apartments or big enough wallets to afford the traditional products that were being sold by the market leaders. And so pretty soon, as they marched up this green trajectory, companies like RCA and Westinghouse, GE, they were in big, big trouble. So finally, there's the value network. As I said, once you come up with the right business model, you need to envelop it in the right commercial ecosystem with appropriate suppliers, proper distribution channels to support your business model in order for it to survive. So RCA and Zenith weren't alone in their marketplace, but they sold, for example, their products through appliance stores. And appliance stores love selling these vacuum tube-based television sets and other appliances because vacuum tubes blew out every now and then, and the appliance stores could make a lot of money in the aftermarket repair of these appliances by sending people out to the owner's homes and replacing vacuum tubes. Now, when Sony first came out into the marketplace, they couldn't get the time of day from the appliance stores because their transistor-based television sets didn't break down. And why would the appliance stores ever want to sell these Sony televisions when they could keep selling vacuum tube-based televisions that would break down and need repair? Fortunately for Sony, there were also discount retailers that were coming into the marketplace, people like Kmart and Walmart. And these discount retailers loved having Sony's products on their shelves because they did not have the expertise or the capacity to deal with home repairs. And so it was really a marriage made in heaven, because here you had Sony making products that never needed repair and never needed service, combined with a retail channel that could provide no service. And so it was this value network, once you tied in the component suppliers, that was able to displace the old value network. And that's really how you can disrupt an entire system. And then finally, just looking at a recent example in the healthcare IT space, you have traditional electronic health records suppliers combined with specialists highly trained in healthcare IT, either in-house or more typically outsourced to IT consultants or consultants owned by or employed by the supplier, and you're selling to very large medical centers. And you contrast that with the recent announcement of eClinicalWorks pairing with Walmart and Dell, two highly disruptive players, very experienced in their own channels, and selling to individual providers and perhaps retail clinics. And that perhaps is a new value network that could disrupt the old one. So thank you very much.